It's the 12th of September, 1990. Republic of Ireland fans stream out of Daly Mount Park after a 1-0 win over Morocco in a friendly. A month later, and we were about to start a qualifying campaign for Euro 92. The mood was a happy one. But little did many know that it would be the last ever international game played at Daly Mount Park. Ireland's successes of Euro 88 and Italian 90 had lit the fire, and that meant much more fans demanding tickets. Now, Lansdowne Road was the favourite venue. Daly Mount, with its capacity of 22,000, just didn't have the space. A month later, 46,000 people would pack into Lansdowne Road to see Ireland's opening Euro 92 qualifier against Turkey. The grand old lady of Irish football had seen her last international. But what a servant to Irish football it was. Some of the greatest players of all time had played on its pitch. It had been the stage of some of Ireland's most famous victories, days and nights of unbridled joy. Some stadiums are where history happens, but Daly Mount Park was history. And for our national team, it was quite simply home for so long. But now that team was on a bigger journey with bigger expectations. And in the autumn of 1990, we started our journey to Euro 92. Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Caelan Kerwin, and Gary Spain. Coming up, we're on the road to Euro 92 with Jack Charlton and his Republic of Ireland team looking to qualify for their third straight major tournament. Remember to share the show on your own social media channels to spread the word about the history and heritage of Irish football on the island. We're also available across the spectrum of podcast platforms, including Spotify, Apple, Amazon, YouTube, and much more. Make sure to turn your notifications on so you can get notified when the podcast goes live on whatever platform you listen to us on. And while you're there, give us 5 stars to show how much you love the show. So let's get on with this week's show. So, Gary, I suppose if we start off in this week's episode, we're going to talk about our qualifying campaign for the 92 Euros. But I suppose give us a little kind of backdrop to where we are in terms of Ireland. The country is on a massive high after Italia 90, as we talked about in one of our previous podcasts. So give us a look at where we are and where the expectancy is, I suppose, going into this qualifying campaign.
Yeah, so I just said we came off a massive high with Italia 90. We'd been drawn against England, which generated huge excitement. I've never seen the demand for a ticket before or since for that England game. In Dublin, and there was huge expectations. I mean, we got to the quarterfinals. Now, England ended up in the semifinals, of course, but there was huge expectations that we could top the group. It was definitely seen as a two-horse race, even though we had Poland and Turkey, and neither of them were any mugs. They were in the group as well. It was a four-team group, and there were no playoffs in those days, so only the group winners were going to the finals in Sweden in the summer of 1992. A straight shootout with England as what it was seen as.
Yeah, and I suppose as well, considering that we the two previous major tournaments that we'd been at, we'd beaten England and we'd drawn with them. So I suppose in our book we kind of looked at it and went, well, you know, we're competing with them. We've got a good chance here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was definitely a feeling that was, we were going in on an equal footing, and we had a really, really good chance of topping the group. And the other thing was coming out of Italia 90, if you look at the way Ireland goes, and sometimes at one point we were vaccine experts and then we become experts on something else. In 1990, everyone in the country was an expert on football, and they all had their own theories and everything because everybody was watching the games. And as I said, the demand for tickets for England was just off the charts, and everybody wanted to be there. And also for the other games, I mean, all the games were totally sold out with high demand, but in particular, the England game was the one with the massive demand.
Absolutely, yeah. Give us a little insight into that England team as well. I mean, we we've become pretty familiar with them in the previous couple of tournaments as well. So talk to us a little bit about that England side as well.
So, I suppose the first thing was Peter Shilton, legendary goalkeeper, had retired after the 1990 World Cup. So he'd been replaced by Chris Woods, who was a very, very talented goalkeeper as well. They still had Gary Lineker up front banging in the goals. I mean, he scored so many goals for England, all-time record goal scorer at one point. I know Harry Kane has taken that since. They had the likes of Peter Beardsley, who was an excellent foil for Lineker. They had the likes of Des Walker, Stuart Pearce, Mark Wright at the back. In midfield, they had the superstar of Paul Gascoigne, but he didn't actually feature in either game. We go on and talk about those. It was for different reasons he didn't start. And likes of Gordon Cowans, David Platt. I mean, they had a lot of household names. They were all very familiar, as always is the case with any English team, because they were on our TV screens every weekend. We knew who they were, and obviously it was a very, very familiar side. But we felt we were a match for them, and we had every chance of going through and knocking them out.
Yeah, and if we were very, very familiar with England, Poland is a different story, and then Turkey on top of that again is even more so.
Yeah, I mean, Turkey were. They did a kind of come a little bit after that, but they were seen as being the whipping boys. And in the end, they didn't get a point. They pushed England actually very hard twice, and they were hard. They were only beaten by a single goal by England in both games, as it turned out. And they were also very strong at home. And certainly they gave us a game as well in the end. But we were expected to beat Turkey twice. Poland were a different kettle of fish. I mean, when I was growing up, Poland came third in the world twice. In 1974, they'd knocked England out of the World Cup, finished in third place. In 1982, again, they finished third. Very strong side. They'd reached the 86 World Cup, but had gone into a bit of decline after that. Didn't really feature in the qualifying for Euro 88 or Italia 90. So they were seen as being a bit of a nation in decline. We didn't know too many of their players. I mean, Robert Varshika, I mean, I might be pronouncing that wrong, but he was a winger with Everton, became a bit of a household name. There was very few foreign players in the English league at the time. And I mean, this was a year before the Premier League started. But he scored a very famous goal when Everton beat Manchester United in Man United's first home game in the Premier League. Everton went to Old Trafford and beat them 3-0. And he got one of the goals. But that was after, obviously, these games. But he would have been known because he'd signed for Everton a little bit earlier. You had the likes of Jan Urban, very talented player playing in Spain, but he wouldn't really have been that well known. We didn't have access to a huge amount of continental football in those days. Jan Furtok, the centre-forward with Hamburg. Again, a very, very decent Polish player, sadly passed away there not too long ago, relatively young age. And star with Hamburg, played most of his career in the Bundesliga. I think he was at Eintracht Frankfurt as well. But he was mainly known for us at Hamburg at that stage. And both of them were to have an impact in the group against us, unfortunately. But most of the Polish names, a lot of them were still playing in the Polish league. We wouldn't have known who they were. We would have expected to beat them. We beat them in a warm-up game for Euro 88 comfortably enough in Dublin. I think it was the send-off game, if I remember rightly. And they weren't expected to pose that big a threat. It was really expected to be between England and ourselves. But, of course, that's not the way it turned out.
What about our own team, the Republic of Ireland as well? Are we pretty much lock, stock and barrel the same as what we saw in Italia 90? Do we have any new faces?
Probably the big new face was, I should talk about before we actually started the qualifying campaign, we said goodbye to Dalymount Park in September 1990 as an international venue, and we played Morocco, and we only beat them 1-0. So David Kelly with a late goal about 16 minutes from time. Dennis Irwin went on to become a legendary fullback, someone who'd probably make many people's all-time Republic of Ireland 11.
And Manchester United 11, to be fair.
And absolutely Manchester United 11 as well. And he made his debut then. So he'd come through kind of after Italia 90. David Kelly, Mark Kelly was there to make an impact, but again, he didn't really, got a few caps, but never really established himself in the team. David Kelly was always there or thereabouts. I mean, he was a great goal scorer. He got a hat-trick in the previous game at Dalymount Park when we hammered Israel the night before we qualified for Euro 88, because that was played the night before the famous Scotland game in Bulgaria. Mm. So he got the winner against Morocco, but he was more of a bit part player. John Byrne was to come in, as someone we'll talk about during the campaign. He was to make an impact in that campaign again. But again, never really became a regular starter, but a hugely talented striker and scored some important goals. But it was a lot of the same faces. Paddy Bonner was still in goal. A lot of the stars of Italia 90, Niall Quinn was there, Tony Cascarino, John Aldridge, Paul McGrath, Andy Townsend, etc. David O'Leary was firmly established back in the team, but Mick McCarthy and Kevin Moran were probably our first choice when available. So a lot of the same faces from Italia 90, but the likes of Dennis Irwin probably coming in and taking the full back spot for his own. And of course, during the campaign, we had another new face that he made his debut, was a certain Roy Keane. So,
yeah, obviously, two absolute legends of the game there. So talk to us a little bit about, before we move on, just talk to us about Dalymount, because it is a significant part of Irish footballing history, isn't it? And in that match with Morocco, was there an awareness that this was the last time that was ever going to be played at Dalymount, or did it just turn out that that's the way it turned out to be?
I think there was generally a feeling that it had come to the end of life. Dalymount is the home of Irish football. It was bought by Bohemians in 1901, and so many big occasions, so many great games were played there. It's still standing, and hopefully it's going to be redeveloped soon. It's still an iconic venue for Irish football. But, I mean, we played France there in February 1989, in a game that finished 0-0, and the French manager, I can't recall who he was at the time, it might have been Michel Hidalgo, I could be wrong, and he said Dalymount was a stadium from another age. And he was trying to be kind, but it was... But, I mean, when I was growing up, the talk was of the famous Dalymount roar, and the feeling was you couldn't bring the atmosphere to Lansdowne Road, it was just too big. But the reality was Lansdowne Road in those days had an awful lot more seats. It was a far bigger venue. I mean, the France game, the Morocco game were sold out, and there were around 19, 20,000 people at the games, and most of those were standing. So it was really difficult. Certainly, I remember it being really, really difficult to get a ticket for the France game. I can't remember Morocco being so difficult, but even though it was the first game after Italia 90, but... There was certainly, I don't think it was actually said at the time that it would have been the end of Dalymount as an international venue, but certainly the feeling was it's Lansdowne Road going forward from now on. And that actually proved to be the case that and even if you fast forward a couple of years, we actually played a friendly against Wales in the RDS when Lansdowne Road wasn't available. I can't recall why, probably with the rugby internationals. Mm. And that was in the spring of 1992. So we played in the RDS rather than in Dalymount Park.
Yeah, there's something about saying goodbye to a stadium, whether in an official capacity or not, that I suppose kind of just leaves something behind, doesn't it? especially for something that has been so synonymous with Irish, not just Irish football, but League of Ireland football, of course, as well, down through the years. So I suppose, unbeknownst to a lot of people, it was a farewell.
Yeah, from the national team, it was certainly a farewell. And even with a redeveloped Dalymount Park, well, it's hard to see that we'd play a senior international there. I'm sure there'll be underage or maybe women's games played there in the future. I hope it gets redeveloped soon. It's an iconic place. It's a special place in the history of Irish football. There's been so many great, great players have graced the venue. Pele's only appearance in Dublin was in Dalymount Park. The Busby Babes played there a few months before the tragic crash in Munich. I mean, there's so many great wins there for the Irish team. I mean, thinking Noel Cantwell against Austria, Iribar's own goal against Spain, the hammering of the West German world champions in 1956. So many great days. The win over the Scottish League in 1939, an oft-forgotten but an incredible win for Irish football back in the day as well. And there's so many other. The great win over the Soviets in 1974, the Don Givens hat-trick, Liam Brady's debut. I mean, special, special days in Dalymount Park. Italy came there as world champions in 1985. And that was one, I think, well, from a health and safety perspective, it's incredible. Nobody was killed that night, you know.
Some incredible memories down through the decades. So we say goodbye to Dalymount Park against Morocco, and it's the first game up for us is Turkey at home and at Lansdowne Road, and in October 1990, and we give Turkey a bit of a thrashing.
Yeah, we give them a right hammering. I mean, John Aldridge with a hat-trick. It was a great day. David O'Leary he'd scored the famous penalty in Genoa, but that was his only international goal, if I remember correctly. A very rare goal from David O'Leary, obviously. But a 5-0 hammering of Turkey. Fantastic start. Niall Quinn with the other one, actually. And that got the crowd. It was an early kickoff as well. We were playing, there was no floodlights in Lansdowne Road in those days, so it was played in the afternoon. I remember something like a 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock kickoff. It was a real party atmosphere. We absolutely battered them. Fantastic start, great boost for our goal difference as well, because it was going to be goal difference was going to decide the group if teams finished level on points. So all in all, a fantastic start, fabulous win, full house, and everybody went home happy. October 1990, we were looking good, sitting on top of the group. Later that night, England beat Poland as expected at Wembley. Who else? Gary Lineker and Peter Beardsley with the goals. But we were very happy with the way that had turned out, and a great start.
Yeah, and it was England up next as well. And I suppose, tell us a little bit about how this game goes, because we kind of leave it a bit late.
Yeah, I mean, my memory is it certainly wasn't a great game. So the pitch in Lansdowne Road was not good in those days. It was a hugely anticipated game. It was a huge game. It was felt like one we needed to win. It wasn't a great game. I don't think either side played well. Graham Taylor, who'd taken over from Bobby Robson as manager, made the strange decision to drop Paul Gascoigne. Now, Gazza had been the star of the 1990 World Cup for Italy. His tears when he realised he was booked against West Germany and would have missed the final if England made it, made him a household name back home. But he'd had a brilliant World Cup. He was a star with Tottenham at the time. He was to go on to sign for Lazio. But he was going to be what we thought the first name on the team sheet. And I remember in Lansdowne Road when I heard the English team, and he was Gordon Cowans replaced him, but he, and Graham Taylor kind of justified it by saying it was going to be a real battle. And he wasn't sure if Gazza had, probably won't do him justice here, but maybe the heart of the for the battle, but he certainly had the talent. It was, I was delighted when he wasn't playing. I mean, that's, that's my thoughts on it, because he was a special talent. He was a great player, but maybe he wouldn't have, the pitch certainly wouldn't have suited him. It certainly proved to be a battle. Maybe it was the right decision. It wasn't a great game. It looked like nil-nil for a lot of the game. Midway through the second half, England scored in a breakaway. David Platt scored, and suddenly things were looking really bad for us. Certainly, if we were to lose that game at home in a two-way shootout, we would have been in big trouble. But we fought back. Tony Cascarino with a fantastic header, levelled it up 10 minutes from time, and which it was probably a fair result. I don't think either team deserved to win the game, and probably neither side deserved to lose. But it wasn't a great game of football. But ultimately, at the end, was feeling, yeah, it was probably a fair result, but maybe slight advantage to England, given that we would have to go to Wembley next.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I suppose sometimes, and we kind of discussed in previous podcasts, sometimes it's a case of just don't lose the game. Whatever you do, like draw, you might be able to pull it back somewhere along the line with other games and other results. But just don't lose this one, because we know this is the one that's going to decide the group.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was definitely a must not lose. I mean, it would have been fantastic to win, but it was definitely a must not lose. And of course, that was what was going to happen at Wembley in the following March as well. Given we'd drawn in Dublin, I mean, if there was to be a winner at Wembley, it was going to be surely decisive.
Is it advantageous as well for Poland too, because their next two games are against Turkey, which obviously they win as well. So that kind of stokes up the pressure behind us as well. And the table, I suppose, is starting to get really tasty around about the time when we play England at Wembley.
Yeah, it was. But I mean, certainly my memory from looking back is we weren't too concerned about Poland at that point. You know, I mean, the focus was very much on England. And the feeling was if there was a winner at Wembley, they were going to be in a very, very strong position to top the group. I mean, as you said, Poland did beat Turkey home and away, but they were probably expected to do that. And I suppose we didn't give them probably the respect they deserve, and we can go on to talk about that. But certainly back in the spring of 1991, we weren't focused on Poland.
So we go to Wembley, and from what I've read, is it fair to say that we're unlucky to not win?
Yeah, let me first mention, actually, the previous month we went to Wrexham to play Wales. And from the heat of Italy, we were playing in, I drove, and it was about minus 10. And we're getting on the ferry. And the night before, we thought the game was going to be off. And there was four of us in the car. And I was driving a small little Opel Corsa at the time. But we decided to go anyway. And driving through the snow in the middle of the night, somehow the game was played and the pitch was covered in snow. There was no way it would have been played these days. But we actually absolutely demolished the Welsh. Niall Quinn was up against Eric Young of Crystal Palace. And, I mean, he was described as Bambi on ice after that performance, because Niall Quinn absolutely demolished him. And there was certainly no doubt that even though Tony Cascarino had scored the crucial goal in Lansdowne Road, that Niall Quinn had to start at Wembley. He was brilliant that night, scored two goals. We won 3-0. And then in much better weather, we're going to Wembley in March. And the feeling was it was going to be the group decider. It was a crucial game. And it's definitely one that every Irish fan will look back at as one that got away. And I think the best people to describe it were the Sun newspaper, which at the time were incredibly jingoistic and incredibly pro-England. And their description was, we should have won 3-1. And I think that's...
Well, if they're saying it...
Yeah, and that was very biased pro-England commentary. That was, I mean, we went behind early on, actually. Lee Dixon put them ahead. It might be down as an own goal as well. But I don't think Steve Staunton wants it, so we'll give it to Lee Dixon. But we came back very well. Niall Quinn equalised early enough, maybe 20-odd minutes, maybe half an hour gone in the game. And I mean, after that, we took over, and Ray Houghton missed a couple of absolute sitters. He put one wide with about 10 minutes to go when it looked easier to score. And we just, in the second half, we just tore them to bits and just could not score. And England held on, somehow held on for a point. And there's actually a great story about Ray and Jack after the game, because, look, Ray had already scored an incredibly famous goal, scored some crucial goals, and was to go on to score a really vital one as well. But he certainly felt he'd left the team down that night, and he said he was avoiding Jack completely. So got changed quickly, went up to the players' lounge, was with his wife, and basically was hiding from Jack. So Jack comes into the players' lounge with a face of thunder on him. Where is he? Where is that? And he walks around and he finds Ray Houghton, and he absolutely lacerates him in front of his wife and using a lot of bad language. And basically Ray just says nothing, and Jack walks away. And Ray's wife says to him, "Are you going to take that from him?" And Ray goes, "Yeah."
He's the guy that picks you.
Well, that's it. And but I mean, it's probably been really unfair, Ray, because it was an absolutely brilliant performance and we played really well and we should have won. It was just the rub of the green. We just did not get it that night. And it was a feeling we were at the top of our game and just could not put them away. We should have won. We were the better team. Didn't see any report, any commentary that said anything else except, unfortunately, it finished 1-1, and it looked like now the only advantage of that was we were thinking, well, okay, we've drawn with England twice, but we have those 5 goals against Turkey in the bag. And that was a brilliant start, because Turkey were proving to be sticky enough to beat.
Hmm. I just wanted to ask you quickly, just on the performance at Wembley and that, it's sometimes something that's leveled against, I suppose, Jack Charlton teams, is that they almost that they couldn't play. In other words, that they would score, or they would put the team under pressure, but that was their thing, and that we didn't really play football under Jack Charlton. I know there's obviously the very public kind of things that Eamon Dunphy said as well, but in this group, and we'll see it later on as well, like, we did score goals, we did bring the match to other teams. So is it an unfair description? Perhaps in major tournaments we probably sat behind the ball a bit too much, but do you think it's unfair to kind of simply label it as we put them under pressure and we were lucky to get goals and then that's how we kind of won?
No, I mean, I actually think there was actually a big improvement from, okay, we only got 2 goals in Italia 90, but I mean, we did put the goals past Turkey. We did struggle in the England game to score, but we created a lot of chances. Mm. And I think it was just poor finishing, bad luck. It really was one that got away. And of course, you'll probably mention the next game against Poland, which is exactly the same story. But I think it would be harsh to be critical in this campaign and the style of play, because we did. I mean, we scored a lot of goals. We got almost as many goals in that campaign as Poland and England put together. Mm. So we did score goals. Our defence left us down at one point as well. But in general, I think we were very unlucky not to come out of that group. We were, if anything, we were the dominant team. We certainly deserve more than 2-1-1 draws against England. We deserve to win the game at Wembley. And I don't think anyone deserved to win the game in Dublin.
So we, as you mentioned, it's May 1991. We're at Lansdowne Road again, and Poland are visiting. Is this a pivotal result, perhaps, in the group?
I think the 2 games against Poland proved to be pivotal for different reasons. I mean, It was May Day 1991. We were certainly, we were hot, hot favourites. We were expected to win. I remember it being a lovely sunny day. The pitch was absolutely shocking. It was, the ball was not, no, the pitch in those days was not great, but it was particularly bad that day. And we just could not score. We did not play well. We were still the better team. Poland just dug in. They were dogged. I remember John Aldridge being rugby tackled to the ground and the ref didn't give the penalty. We had a goal chopped off for offside that seemed very harsh for, sorry, not for offside. I think it was a foul on the goalkeeper that seemed incredibly harsh as well. Most people thought it was a goal, a good goal. It was just one of those days and the ball just would not go in the net. And certainly that day, again, it was an early kickoff. That day was seen as pivotal because England went on to eke out a very narrow win in Turkey. Dennis Wise with the only goal. They just about got over the line. Didn't deserve it. Turkey had great chances to equalise. So we couldn't get the goal against Poland. We should have won. They got the 1-0 win against Turkey. And the feeling was that was the certainly a pivotal day in the group. And England were now in the driving seat.
Hmm. So we take a little bit of a break in terms of internationals, in terms of qualifiers, sorry, as we get a friendly with Chile, a 1-1 draw at Lansdowne Road. But what is the World Series of Soccer and how did we end up in Foxborough, Massachusetts for it?
So, I mean, we were household names at the time and we were, we got quite a, so we were invited to play the USA in Foxborough. And it was just an end of season game. We were invited again the following summer. We went, if I remember, we went in 96, we went in 2000. We were pretty regular visitors to the US back in those days. We were drawing a big crowd with Irish Americans as well. Maybe the most famous thing in that USA game, and a man who was very unlucky to get a cap was Johnny Glynn, because I actually worked with Johnny in Galway, in Digital Galway at the time, and I knew him well. He'd got the winning goal for Galway in the Cup, Galway Rovers, or was it Galway United then? They won the Cup in 1991. Sorry, it was definitely Galway United. They beat Shamrock Rovers. Johnny got the winning goal. He was at the top of his game at the time. And he's a lot of family in the States. He just happened to be on the flight, the same flight as the team. And Jack got chatting to him and said, well, did you bring your boots? And they sorted out boots and he was added to the squad. I don't know if there was a couple of injuries or whatever. And we actually went to goal up in the second half and Johnny was told to warm up and he was going to come on and get a cap. And unfortunately, the USA equalised and told to sit down again.
Heartbreaker.
Heartbreak, you know, and I mean, so that was the closest. He almost got a full international cap. Brilliant guy, huge name in Galway football. Also played with Cork City and a League of Ireland legend, still involved in coaching, etc. But that American goal, I think it was Eric Winalda got the equaliser and it unfortunately denied Johnny his cap. He has all the gear. He got all the gear, but he didn't get a cap.
If it's that easy to get a call up, how come you never got a, you must have been on plenty of flights.
Jack never saw me playing football and he's paid by that. I would never have been near any squad, don't worry.
Thank God, says you.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully there's no video evidence of me playing football as far as I know. It's
that's a great story. And look, I know he didn't get on, but I mean, what an incredible story. You meet the Ireland manager on a plane and he asks you to come play.
Absolutely brilliant story, and so close to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I suppose, look, that's the swings and roundabouts of football, isn't it? So we have a friendly then with Hungary.
Yeah, so in September, again, there were no qualifiers because we were in a 4-team group. There were no games fixed for September, so we go to Győr and we beat Hungary 2-1, which is seen as a nice warm-up for Poland in Poznan the following month. And well, again, we would have been expected to beat Hungary in those days, and when we did.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because the recent run of form would have seen we draw with England, draw with Poland. I know they were essentially friendlies, but we draw with Chile, we draw with the United States. Was there any concern that this was something was creeping into the side that we didn't want there? Maybe some complacency or finishing was off or something?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I suppose, I mean, we've often talked about our 1-1 victories as well. But 1-1 was a reasonably common score under Jack as well. But no, I don't remember anything about complacency, but certainly the feeling was we have to go to Poznan and beat Poland to get back in the race. And the Hungary was just seen as a good warm-up. But I don't think friendlies weren't that important in those days, and the result didn't make a huge difference. I mean, it was all down to the qualifiers, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And we have to go to Poznan. And essentially, as you say, it's a kind of a must-win game. I suppose a must-win game for both teams. Talk to us about this match, because it's dramatic.
It's dramatic. It was an incredible game of football. It was played in a fantastic atmosphere. There was a huge Irish crowd there. The previous night, actually, Poland under-21s had qualified for the Olympics. They'd beaten us in Bydgoszcz in the under-21 game, and even that game was live on TV. I was at that match as well, and there was huge celebration. So Polish football had come on a bit of a high. There was a feeling that a good group of players coming through. The game in Poznan, big game, huge travelling support, and we played really, really well for most of the game. Paul McGrath put us ahead early on. We controlled the first half, got caught early in the second half. But again, having been pulled back to 1-1, just took a stranglehold on the game. Andy Townsend and Tony Cascarino had us 3-1 up midway through the second half. And it appeared to be game over. We were in total control. Miles the better team. And unfortunately, in the last 10, 12 minutes, we just fell apart and gifted them 2 goals. If I remember rightly, one of them was David O'Leary at fault. The other was definitely Paddy Bonner. It was rare errors from the two of them. But we gifted 2 goals to Poland. And those two Jans, Jan Fortok and Jan Urban, pulled it back to 3-3. And it was definitely a game we should have won, could have won. I mean, to score 3 goals away from home like that, and to have a defence that we had was so strong at the time, it was really incredible that we failed to win the game, and to concede three goals in that second half was incredible and really disappointing.
England beat Turkey a couple of hours later on the same day. And is that nail in the coffin time, or is it we've got a squeaky chance, or how are we?
Well, we had a real chance, because what that meant was, now England made hard work of that game. It was a 1-0 win again. I think Alan Smith got the goal. It actually meant any of the three teams could have qualified going into the last day. But England were in the driving seat. They only needed a draw in Poznan. Poland needed, I think, a 2-goal win, if I remember, maybe a 3-goal win. And we needed to beat Turkey and hope Poland had a narrow win over England. I think Poland needed a 3-goal win. It was quite a big gap in the goal difference. Realistically, Poland needed us to drop points in Turkey. If we'd drawn in Turkey and Poland won, they would have topped the group. So it was still all to play for. And of course, in those days, we had no mobile phones and you had no way of getting the other results. And so
the news wire on the wireless, was it?
Well, there wasn't. I mean, there was no wireless. Well, there probably was a wireless in Turkey, but I don't think anyone in the away end spoke Turkish. So we were in the away end. We had no way of knowing the score for the first half, but word did come through that Poland had taken the lead after about half an hour. Now, it had been a bit. We were actually missing quite a few players that night as well. It was a weakened Irish side. I think the likes of Ronnie Whelan was out. trying to remember who else was out. But it was certainly the night of nights for John Byrne. He gave us an early lead. We gave away a penalty. Turkey equalised quite quickly. Even though they hadn't a point in the group, the stadium in Istanbul was packed to the rafters and the atmosphere was incredible. It was absolutely nuts. And it was incredible atmosphere. Even the under-21 game the night before in the old Ali Sami Yen Galatasaray Stadium. Again, nothing at stake. Two of us were bottom of the group. And on a Tuesday afternoon, they packed out the stadium. And when they actually beat us later on, they celebrated like they'd won the World Cup. So the atmosphere in football in Turkey in those days and to this day was absolutely incredible. And so even though there was nothing at stake for Turkey, it was an incredible atmosphere. We were 1-1 at halftime. Poland were winning 1-0. And at halftime, Poland were heading to Sweden against all the odds. And early in the second half, we took control of the game. John Byrne scored again. Tony Cascarino, I think actually Cass's goal came first. But we went 3-1 up early enough in the first 10, 15 minutes of the second half. And we were in control of the game after that. But we didn't know the score in Poland. We didn't know how it was going. Now, obviously, anyone sitting at home was able to watch the game. And Poland were in control 14 minutes from time. They should have had a penalty. It was a nailed-on penalty, and the referee didn't give it. And within 60 seconds, they were up the other end of the pitch, and Gary Lineker equalised to send England to the final. So it was right in the balance until 13 minutes to go. And I know, because I remember from the final whistle, we were baffled at the final whistle whether we qualified or not. And the fans were chanting, "What's the score in Poland?" And Mick McCarthy put up two fingers to show 1-1. And that's how I found out that we were out. And although we could kind of guess from the way the players, they came over to the fans, but they weren't celebrating.
Mm.
But unfortunately, that was the way it was.
What was that like? Because Irish football had been on such an incredible high for, you know, 4 or 5 years. It was really just going into the kind of into the stratosphere, and all of a sudden we're back down to earth. What was the feeling? I suppose first of all from yourselves in the stadium, but I suppose when you got back home as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was really gut wrenching. I mean, I actually took a few days to go home. Went to see a big Istanbul derby on the Saturday, as you do.
That's not like you, Gary.
No, Fenerbahce Beşiktaş 2-2, and another incredible atmosphere again over in the Asian side. So it took me a few days to get home. But actually, the other thing was in those days, you really had to stay a Saturday night to get any kind of a cheap flight. So when the game was on a Wednesday, we went to Poland on the Saturday, stayed the Saturday night, got to the games in Bydgoszcz and Poznań, and then were able to fly home on the Thursday. So you needed a Saturday night stay for pretty much all those trips. Otherwise, the flights went through the roof. And so it was actually cheaper to go for a longer period of time once you get the time off work, because hotels were cheap enough and living costs in the likes of Poland and Turkey would have been very cheap in those days. So by the time we got back, it was probably already off the newspapers. But certainly from a fan's point of view, we were gutted. We'd missed out in Euro 92. And it was a feeling that we had had a better team than we had gone to Italia 90. And the feeling was, had we gone there, we would have done damage. And then you're watching Euro 92 from home, as I didn't go, I watched it from home. And you're seeing the likes of Denmark, who only qualified because of the war in the Balkans at the time, and Yugoslavia had to withdraw. So Denmark got in their place and they went on and won the tournament. And there was certainly, it could have been us. It could have been us. Now, look, you'll never know. I mean, the England team that knocked us out didn't do much. They went out in the group stages. They needed a goal. And famously, Graham Taylor, they probably signed his death warrant. He did get another campaign out of it, but he brought Alan Smith. If I remember correctly, he brought Alan Smith off the bench. And also on the bench was a very young man called Alan Shearer, who had actually destroyed our under-21s in Cork in the under-21 campaign. It was the first time I got to have a look at him. He was playing with Southampton, and I was actually behind the goal in the shed, and he scored a couple of fantastic goals. And he was on the bench for Euro 92, never got off. And Alan Smith came on instead. And of course, Shearer went on to become a household name and a fantastic striker. So definitely probably a mistake by Graham Taylor there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, probably one of the cleanest strikers of a ball that there ever was. Alan Shearer, he always just seemed to hit it just right. And that's how I think sometimes he managed to get that huge amount of power as well in his shooting too.
Absolutely. And I mean, a legend later at Blackburn and, of course, at Newcastle United, his hometown club. But he started off at Southampton. I'm pretty certain he was at Southampton when he scored those goals for the 21s. And he was the talk of that game when they took us apart that day.
Absolutely, yeah. I wanted to talk to you about the group as well, because one of the things that had gone in our favour before for qualifying for the World Cup had been that there was five teams in our group, so two kind of got their way through. There was only four in our group now. So did that kind of go against us as well?
Well, there were only going to be seven, so there were only going to be eight places in the finals anyway. So for the World Cup, remember, UEFA had more spaces. So I think it was it 12 of the 24, if I remember rightly. So around 11 or 12 in 1990. So it was harder to qualify for Euros in those days because it was only an 8-team tournament. So there were seven groups. So I don't think it made too much of a difference. We were in a 4-team group and most of the groups were 5 teams. But the 5th team was a minnow like San Marino or Malta or whatever. And I don't think it would have made a huge difference if we had a minnow in the group. I think it was just not to be. It was those two Poland games, the chances at Wembley, and if the ref had given that penalty to Poland at the end against England, Gary Lineker wouldn't have scored 60 seconds later. You know, it's so close. I mean, it's just so much one that got away. There's so many what ifs. There's so many if onlys. And I was just going to say one of my favorite quotes. I was a writer called John Greenleaf Whittaker, and he said, of all the words of tongue and pen, the saddest of these, what might have been. And it definitely applies in this case, what might have been.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's kind of similarities, and not necessarily in perhaps the results or what happened in those results, but with kind of the maybe Owen Hand or something like that, where we had really great talent within the team. They could have done so much, but they just didn't get to the tournament to show what they could do proper.
Yeah, and I mean, we can talk forever about the 82 campaign. And
we did.
I suppose 10 years' time, 10 years after that, it was the 92 campaign as well. Now, maybe it was a case we got the rub of the green in 87 when Gary McCoy got that winner in Sofia. So maybe it was a little bit of payback that we certainly didn't get the rub of the green in 91 to qualify for Euro 92. But it certainly felt like it definitely was one that got away, and it hurt. Yeah, I mean, watching that finals, we felt we could have done damage. We would have been really good. I think we were a better team in 92 than we were in 1990.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose when you look at the final table as well, we kind of touched on it earlier, which was our scoring too. England score 7, Poland score 8. We scored 13 goals in that qualifying campaign as well. So we absolutely were sticking the goals in, perhaps not at the right time in the right matches, but we certainly stuck a lot of goals in, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. I mean, that maybe we'd solve the problem from Italia 90 of not scoring enough goals. But you go back to those games in March and May 91 when we just couldn't get the winner in the second half at Wembley, and in the whole 90 minutes at home against Poland, we had so many chances and we just couldn't put the ball in the net as well.
Absolutely, yeah. The goal scoring charts, John Aldridge and Tony Cascarino topped the charts, and then Gary Lineker, John Byrne, Niall Quinn, and Ryszard Terazwakowicz, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. If I'm not, I apologize. with two goals. But yeah, we certainly did score goals. What's the feeling then about where we are then as a team, about Jack Charlton, etc., as we move forward? Because obviously, by the sounds of it, we played incredibly well. We might not have gotten the results, but we were definitely playing good football.
We were. I mean, we felt like we'd improved as a side. We were certainly looking. The next World Cup is going to be in the good old US of A, as it is next year. And with the incredible Irish population over there, we had gone there in the summer of 91. We'd gone there in the summer of 92. Certainly the feeling was we were going to be going back there in the summer of 94. And it was going to be all eyes on World Cup 94. We were good enough not just to qualify, but the feeling was we were good enough to go there and really make an impact.
Absolutely, yeah. And we're going to be covering that on our next podcast as well. The qualifying campaign, not the tournament itself, because that qualifying campaign was had its own dramatic moments as well, especially that night in Windsor, as they say.
Absolutely, but so many dramatic moments in that campaign. It's certainly it's one that's certainly worthy of a podcast on its own.
Absolutely,
because there were so many twists and turns, and what a campaign.
And you know what? It is getting a podcast of its own, because that's going to be the next podcast when we start talking about our qualifying campaign for the 1994 World Cup and what a campaign it was. So join us next time for that. Until then, Gary, thanks as ever for your stories and your football knowledge, as well as we looked at our failure to get to Euro 92. Well, that's it for this week's show. Coming up on our next podcast, we're looking to qualify for the World Cup in the USA 94, and what a campaign that was. So make sure to turn your notifications on so you can get notified when that podcast goes live. Share the show on your own social media channels to spread the word about the history and heritage of Irish football on the island. And remember to support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League team. It's our history, it's our game. Until next time, bye for now.